It's after he came out of the army, young William, as we called him, I got to know him, and we did have a good relationship, really. He was very, very nice chap. And when he got married, because he, you know, met his wife, and latterly, cause I know he's got a family. Well, he's got, I think, a son and a daughter. I think his son lives in Australia.
That's right.
Yeah. Is that right?
Yes.
I didn't know whether he was back in this country. Mm. But after I got married, we used to meet. I used to see him and his wife at concerts because he was a member, as we were, of the Holmes Chapel Musical Society near Knutsford. And I think he was friendly with Sir Bernard Lovell, who was the patron, a well-known organist in the area. So, but we used to meet very often, meet him there. But, of course, apart from those odd musical meetings, I lost contact with the family after I left. And I finished, I didn't go back to the Rose Nursery. I finished in the herbaceous and shrub department. And decided, of course, that I wanted to earn a bit more than I was earning there. I think it was a case of, I know, I was paying the old lady I mentioned off so much a week for the motorcycle to get there.
Yes.
And I was also giving my mother, I think, 10 shillings a week towards my keep. So there was very little left for petrol.
Can you remember how much you were earning then?
Yes, 35 shillings and sixpence.
Right, yeah.
£1.50 and two.
Yeah.
I don't know, it varied a bit, but I don't know, I don't think it was much more, if at all. And then I can remember that when I left, of course I'd been doing a bit of gardening for people and growing things on my own. I rented part of a field at the back of my parents' house in Poynton and started doing things in the Saturday afternoon and Sunday sort of thing, and then realised that I could earn more in a day working for myself than they were paying me for a week. With all that travelling and required. So, you know, it was, there was no...
Is that what you did then? Is that what you did? Set yourself up and...
Yeah. Yeah. So...
And what sort of things were you? What were you growing?
So I was growing alpines, and I was growing a few roses. Myself a few roses. Of course, in those days, so eventually I was able to get some from Holland. I got hold of William Calder let me have a trade magazine, which was rather secret in those days, which gave some addresses, and I got contact with a Dutchman who I became friendly with for years. And he supplied me with a few briars, but you could only get a very limited amount. And you whatever you bought from Holland in those days, you had to pay the Dutchman. He'd give you credit very often. Very often he'd take the order one year and you'd pay him when he came for the next. Mm-hmm. But you couldn't, the stuff came through Hull, for the north of England anyway, through an importer, and they wouldn't release it until they've got the money, until you paid them. And the import duties could be a lot more than the cost of the plants.
Yes, yes.
Having said that, you know, it was still more profitable than I realised at the time.
So is that how you made your living most of your time?
Well, yes, I started doing laying out garden, people's garden, and new properties and that were being built, and then growing a bit of stuff myself, and on the rented ground, my father then moved to Bowden, and I was able to get some land, 2 acres of land behind their house, and quite cheaply. And I was growing tomatoes and lettuce and a bit of everything, really. Yeah. And selling to local shops. And then I took a stall on Altrincham Market. But, I mean, the sort of thing that, you know, you could buy for coppers in price in Holland for trees and shrubs and lilacs that were selling for pounds in England. Mm-hmm. All right, you've got to pay your import duty, so that would double. Mm-hmm. If it was 3 and 6 in Holland, it was 7 shillings by the time you got it here. Mm-hmm. But it might be worth 15 shillings or a pound to you, which is profit that you wouldn't make today on importing stuff. Yeah. If I'd realised, you know, I would have borrowed a lot more money from the bank and done a lot more importing and but you don't realise these things. So. But Caldwell's, of course, I knew eventually wanted to get married, and my wife was not very well at the time, but she was very keen on floristry, wanted to learn to be a florist, and I'd learnt a certain amount, and we got the chance of an empty shop with a flat in Knutsford for £1 a week. We wondered how we could afford it, and she decided I'd be growing, and she would do a florist bit and sell me flowers in the shop, and that's actually how we started. Of course, Caldwell's was still in operation then, the nurseries, and he'd always let me have stuff at trade price if I'd got orders for stuff. You know, I could go there, and I kept in touch with the family. And then eventually, the florist business flourished to such an extent that I had to give up the growing because I was too busy. I had to go to market every week, and every day rather, early in the morning, and with a big trade. But my wife suffered with asthma, and eventually she was told the pollen was the worst thing that she could do. She got to get out of that business. And I was offered a job. It was a long story, really. I didn't know what an agent was in those days. We had reps, obviously, coming in the shop, selling stuff on behalf of companies. And one company was a bulb company. Right. And they'd lost their rep. And one of their... They were the head of the company, actually, a bulb company in Kent. Was a Dutchman he imported from his family in Holland. And he said, you must know a lot of people in the trade. So he came in for the order, basically. I said, well, the shop's up for sale. My wife said, I've got to get rid of it. I want to sell it while it's going good, before it, you know. Well, what are you going to do? I said, I haven't decided to go back to landscape gardening properly. Oh, so he said, well, do you know people in the trade? You know, can you sell? You've sold me bulbs in the shop. So I said, well, I can't give you an artist, you'll have to come and see the new people that are taking over. He said, well, what about selling on commission? He said, I can't take you on as a rep, but he said, if you can sell my stuff, pay a commission. And it was as casual as that. He said, if you want to take other lines on, that's up to you. He said, you know what an agent is? I said, no. So he told me, you see, that I'll be a manufacturer's agent. And I joined the Manufacturers Agents Association, and that's how I started on the road as a salesman for horticulture products. And I did that for nearly 30 years.
Goodness.
Pot covers, seeds. I got the agency for the, I was the first man in north of England for Thompson and Morgan, which nobody knew about, but it's now a well-known company.
Yes, yes.
Thompson and who? Never heard of them.
Yes.
Oh, no. Yeah, 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 they had. It was a specialist company who sold to head gardeners very rare seeds. Mm. And the man, actually, we sold in the shop at Knutsford, the seeds of a firm called Johnson's of Boston, Lincolnshire, well-known, W.W. Johnson. And I got to know the rep very well, Ron, and he knew what had happened, of course, that I'd sold out, and he rang me up one day. He said, I've left Johnson's, I've become sales manager for Thompson and Morgan. And I think I probably said, never heard of him, you know. He said, well, he said, they're well known amongst the real horticultural people and head gardeners and big estates if you want rare shrubs, rare plants. But he said, we're going into, he said, a very keen photographer, one of the sons, the Sangster family ran it, and one of the sons was keen on colour photography. Well, in those days, seed packets were very bare and plain. They weren't beautiful coloured packets. And he was the first man to, the word crude colour pictures, but they weren't accurate colour illustrations of the plant you were supposed to be getting. I think Riders were the first ones of St Albans who did a packet with a bit of colour on it. But the big firms like Sutton's were completely plain. And of course, there was an elitism about it, you see, and Ron said, would I go to a meeting at a hotel down in the Midlands, and I did, and I liked the sound of this. They'd only got 16 varieties, a little trial arrangement. They said, if it goes well, we'll increase the range. So I took these round my customers who had, in those days, originally there was no garden centres, it was just nurseries with a little shed at the side of the road selling a few plants, you see. And put this on the counter. Banana seed, Ken, you must be joking. In the north, you'll never sell this sort of stuff. It was all unusual. Strelitzia regina, the bird of paradise.
Yes.
To take about 6 months to flip it on germinate. Anyway, they were gift things, really. They were things that you bought Grandad for Christmas, who was interested. But they weren't, you didn't expect them to grow, you see. But they sold, because they were attractive. They were beautifully illustrated. And because I can remember one big garden centre operator reluctantly take it. Well, he said to him, no, he said, you must be joking. We can't sell stuff like that. He said, well, people want a seed packet with all they want is the Latin name and the growing instructions. And what he said, they don't want all that fancy stuff, not proper gardeners. They, you know, so that's what we sell. So I said, look, I said, when I was a child, I was at wit's end then to know what to say to him, really. But I said, when I was a child, I said, and I wanted a gramophone record of a certain piece of music. I said, there'd be a label on it. It'd be, say, Mr. Pablo Casals, cello, Brahms. I said, oh, that was it. I said, what do you get today? Of course, this is years ago. I said, you get a big vinyl sleeve, beautiful coloured illustration, a picture of Mozart's birthplace and the history of Mozart on the other side. I said, they want the full treatment and in colour. Well, I'll try them, he said, you see. And of course, he'd sold out of bananas before he'd sold out of anything. And it went like a house on fire. And now, of course, they've got big racks of Thompson and Moore. It's huge.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that was how it all started.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, of course, I was in at the
beginning.
Birth of yeah. Regarden Centres in the north of England.
Yeah.
First one was near Bournemouth, was going back to the 60s, but not in the north. The first one in the north was near Preston, Barton Grange. That was the first one.
Yeah.
But the owner of it, his father had a hotel, you see, and it was a nice little corner site next to the hotel. That's how it all started. He started with a market stall in Rochdale, actually, Eddie Topping. Anyway.
Can I just take you back to a couple of things, if you don't mind?
Yes.
One is college, because I think early on you went to Stockport College.
Oh, well, NHS. I did. In those days, you could take the RHS exams, which were divided into a junior and senior.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of gave you a stepping stone into not just commercial horticulture, but more into the main parks departments and things like that.
Yes.
And that was my intention in the first place. And I enrolled at Stockport College when I was at Poynton for the RHS Junior course. And at the end of that, I went to see the curator. It was the head of Stockport Parks Department, which was then based in Lyme Park, basically his offices. And of course, he controlled the whole of the parks, you see. And reading Alan Titchmarsh's autobiography reminded me that he did the similar sort of thing, you see. Anyway, my father was more approving that I got a job in a gardener on the nursery, you see. But of course, I went round the nurseries, and then I went to meet this man, and I forget his name, who was then the head of parks, and he talked to me. He was a very, very interesting chap. He said, I was like you, son. He said, I was idealistic. And he said, I wanted to get my hands dirty and learn about plants. And he said, you'll never have enough money to get married on that. He said, all right. He said, I earn a good living now. I'm head of parks department. He said, I'm pushing a desk and a pen all day long. He says, I never get a chance to get out and do any growing myself.
Yeah.
He said, I don't want to do it this way, but he said, this is how it is. He says, I want to earn any money at all. He said, it's an office job. He said, it's not a growing job here. He said, you won't go on nurseries if you want to grow or try and have a nursery of your own. And that was his advice. And I realise now that, as Alan had done, of course, it was a boring job, because even the planning from the growing end, in those days it was straight rows of alyssum and lobelia, and there was no variety. There was no... Mm. All the things like... I've shown you the advert, Land of No Rock Gardens, which were absolutely brilliant in the 30s. Because of the labour. They were so labour-intensive.
Yes.
But all those wonderful rock gardens went to pot during the war, and they've never really come back. Yeah. Not to that extent.
There are... some being restored, aren't there? But
they're trying, but in some cases, but you can't use a rotavator in a rock garden. So this is the whole problem. It's too labour-intensive and too costly. So I realised, no, it was boring. So that's when I decided I was going to Caldwell's.
And the other thing was, because you've mentioned quite a lot of the people in charge and the family, what about the other people that you worked with when you were at, the other people, other people working there?
Yes, like Sid and so forth. Well, as I say, most of the... I was in a funny position, really, because I was neither one thing nor the other. All the men I worked with were, they'd worked basically on farms or nurseries all their life, and they'd never hardly been out of nuts, mostly. You know, they thought people in Mobley were a bit weird. Oh yeah. No, it was really, so they were really, it was really a close society, all these villages and so forth. And, they were very limited. I mean, I learnt a bit on the growing side, but generally speaking, there was none of them had any education of any sort. I hadn't had a good education, but I can remember Percy Allcroft saying to me, "Oh, it's all right for you grammar school boys." Yeah. And I said, "I'm not a grammar school." I said, "I didn't get to grammar school, didn't you?" And he couldn't understand it because I spoke in those days very slightly better, not much better. I didn't swear quite as much. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I appeared to them.
Yes. Yes.
In fact, some of the younger lads called me Poshy. Which had been called I was born in Altrincham, in Timperley, but my mother and father moved around. And he'd decorate the house, and I decided he'd want to change, Anyway, I was brought up, most of my school days were in Poynton, as I've said, from 7 till 20.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a mining village in those days.
Yes.
The mines had closed in 1936, but all the children at Poynton School spoke such a strong dialect, I couldn't understand what they were saying, and they couldn't understand me. So I was Poshy because I'd come from Sale there. We lived in Sale before we moved to Poynton. Ashton on Mersey or Barker's Lane. They were a rough lot, really, the time. And it's a posh commuter area now, but it certainly wasn't then. It was,
Did somebody say there were prisoners of war there as well?
Oh, well, that's very interesting, yes. There was a big POW camp at Mobley.
Yeah.
And they found people there were sent to work on farms and nurseries. And Italians and Germans, mainly. The Germans were more educated types than the Italians. There was quite a number of Italians, but I got quite friendly. A lot of the Germans, some of them married local girls in Alton, and still there, apparently. But there was a Latvian there that worked on the Rose Nurseries. But yes, quite a lot of. As I say, I didn't get to know many of them because they didn't. We didn't speak the language basically, and it took them a long time. They could understand you better than they could, than you could understand them, if in other words. But it was a famous camp because I don't know if you ever heard of the famous German economist E.F. Schumacher, who wrote Small is Beautiful.
Yes.
Well, he was there.
Good Lord.
Yeah. And I believe he worked at Caldwell's for a time, but I didn't know. But I read the book. Well, I've read his old books, but I've read a book, which I'm trying to get a copy of, by his daughter, my father, E.F. Schumacher. By his daughter, Margaret. And he was interned originally, and then he was sent to that camp because he was an alien. I mean, he was at Oxford. He was in England when the war broke out, but he was interned because he was of German origin, you see. But wonderful man, wonderful book. And he was there. But years later, my daughter had a pen for, well, there was a school exchange like you have. Yeah. She went to Lym Grammar School, and they had an exchange with a school in Attendorn in Germany, which is east of Cologne in the Harz Mountains. And she was friendly. She's still friendly. We still get letters from Christiana, from this girl. And we were invited over to visit them, and when Christine was staying with over there, we did exchanges, you know, like they do. She visited us, and my daughter went over there, and we were camping at a site called the Listersee, which was near the Biggersee, and the Biggersee was the big lake with the Myrna Dam that was destroyed or damaged by bombers. And it was that area of dams and mountains. It was an interesting area, forested area. And I pitched our little frame tent in the area allocated, and there were some Dutch people next to us. We'd got Malcolm with us, who was only about 7 or 8, and Christine was old, you see. She was staying at the Hofacker's house, the Penfriend's house. And I put my tent up, but when I came to drive the pegs in stony ground, I'd remembered everything but the mallet. Oops, sorry. Is that all right? Yeah. And the mallet was missing out of the toolkit. So I had to use a big heavy wrench out of my car kit to hammer the, and this tall German from the next tent, which was a huge marquee like Chelsea Flower Show, you know, colossal, magnificent thing. So he emerged with allow me, you see. Oh, so that's very kind of you. So, yes, and when you have finished, when you have, meine Frau would like, why, you see. So, come. So I put the tent up with this mallet, and we all trooped around to see his wife. And she'd got this table laid out with a magnificent spread of goodies, you see, for a meal. And we were invited in and sat down. And I said to this Paul Lefert's his name, yeah. So to him, I said, where did you learn English? He said, that is a long story. And he was on a U-boat in the Irish Sea, and they were captured, and or he was sunk and he was escaped and he was captured in a life raft, I think, and taken to a prisoner of war camp near Liverpool. on his ship from Liverpool to Moberly, and he worked at Caldwell's.
Good.
I said, you're joking. I worked, so, oh, of course, we knew all that. We didn't remember each other at the time, but I must have seen him. Oh, it's just a small world, isn't it? You know, yeah.
Yes.
He says, I can't believe that. I said, well, I can't believe that. But the strange thing is, of course, well, not strange, it was sad. The tent next to us were Dutch people. And we liked it. I mean, we've been to Holland a lot because of the nursery bit. I've been over there myself, buying later on.
Yeah.
And Christine and Malcolm had been with us. And because little Malcolm was keen on football, and he was playing with these Dutch boys. But as soon as they saw me speaking to Paul Lefert, they wouldn't allow their children to play with them. But Malcolm said to me, he said, Dad, he said, he's a nice man, that. So I said, yes, he's very nice. I said, are some nice German. But he's a German. All Malcolm had got was a diet of Colditz on the telly. He couldn't believe that he could be a nice man. It was strange, you know.
Yes.
But that was the experience there. And we had previous to that been on holiday we used to go over to Holland, and I used to visit nurseries and all the stuff, and we'd take the tent and camp, you see, with the children, and go on the North Sea ferry. I'd take my little van over on North Sea ferry to, in those days it was from Hull to Amsterdam, sailed up the North Sea Canal. You don't do that now, I don't think it's open. But we were staying originally, the first few nights at Rotterdam, in a flat that my wife had organised, because it was a scheme for teachers, actually, that they did an exchange. You could, if you agreed to let your house, you could have their house. It was a special educational thing. Anyway, we had this place on the side of the canal in Rotterdam, which is a lovely flat. And the owners of the flat, the people we got friendly with, lived on the lower ground floor and let the upper part of it. And we walked around Rotterdam, around one of the big parks one day with the children, and there was a big fat Dutchman selling ice cream, you see, and ice cream, my kids wanted an ice cream, you see. So I knew Margaret had got, we originally went to Holland because Margaret had got a pen friend before we were married, so she'd was friendly with the Dutch family, and we were going to visit them as well. And she, of course, had told me that I knew a bit of German, and that would be all they would understand. They would understand a very similar language, you see. So, of course, I'm saying to my wife, I'm asking her in German what she would want, you see. And this man stood there glowering at us with a stony face. He wouldn't speak, he wouldn't. So in the end, I said to Margaret, I said, I'm sorry, but I've got to get served here. I said, he doesn't understand German. You are English! What the hell you speak to him? And he went, see, he went mad.
Yes, yes.
He said, you speak English here, not German. My brother was killed by the bloody Germans. And I heard this sad story of the experiences of the Germans.
Of
said to Margaret, don't ever encourage me to speak German there again.
No, I think that happens in other parts of the world as well. In parts in Italy, for example, it's a very interesting combination. North, very north.
Oh, yes, because they suffered, and they also were very good to the English prisoners, weren't they?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But that was the story of going to Holland. But,
Finally, then, are there other things that you, because you've told us a tremendous amount, are there other things you that I haven't asked or that you'd want to mention about Cordwells, do you think?
Well, no, I can give you a list of the names I remember of the staff. And I would be very interested if we could get hold of Sid Taylor or Mrs. Mavis Caldwell.
Yes.
Because she might remember.
Yes.
You see, I remember that after the office, I've told you about the office staff. They had two travellers, reps, and one was called Bill Burgess and one was called Joe Jones, who will no longer be with us, older than me. And they used to go around all in those days, the head gardeners, and take their orders, you see. And there was another old man who I was fascinated by. And I've put a question mark there. I'll give you this because I've had to do it like that because I can't read it, but I've written otherwise. But this man here, Mr. Boardman, was the rep in the 20s and the 30s. And he'd been provided with a Ford car, a Ford 8 to go round. And he'd obviously been given it on his retirement. Now, Mr. Boardman, or if that's his name, he was in his 80s when I remember him at the end of the war. He lived in a beautiful cottage, which I hope is still there, I don't know, at Jodrell Bank, or Withington. And it was on the main road, I remember that, and he bred delphiniums. He was a well-known breeder, and he of course, provided Caldwell's with a lot of name varieties of delphiniums. And that was his hobby after he retired. And this was very much in the nature, you know, the story of George Russell and Bakers of Wolverhampton, I presume. Baker's nurseries at Codsall Wolverhampton are another very old nursery. Not as old as Caldwell's, but another old nursery. And they employed an old chap called George Russell, who was a breeder of Russell Lupins. And they became the famous Russell Lupin. And they sold them exclusively. But this old chap, as I say, had a beautiful garden. And I believe he lived into his 90s, but I'm not sure. Mm. He was a big man, but there was an occasion, which is amusing today to people, wouldn't believe it possible, but I'd no doubt he'd been driving and working for Caldwell's and driving round these nurseries and head gardeners since the 1920s, since he started work there. But he was asked to visit some big customer in Buxton to look at some, or to plant, to plant something. We took a spade with us, to plant something in this garden, and I can't remember the details. But he had to take the landscape foreman who'd laid the garden in Buxton out with him, who sat in the front, and I sat in the back of this car, and holding the spade. And we were detailed to go up there. And the old man went up the Cat and Fiddle Road, from Macclesfield. We'd got there all right. And going up the Cat and Fiddle, and he was, he and Frank Yarwood the old chap who was a landscape foreman, were in deep conversation. They don't know each other all their life. And I remember worrying, I wish he'd looked where he was going, you know. But that wasn't the problem. But the car, the old car, they only had three gears, those old Fords. But it was going, I mean, I only rode a motorbike in those days because I knew enough about vehicles. I'd got uncles and aunts with cars. I knew he should have changed gear miles before. But the thing gradually shuddered to a halt halfway up before we got to the top, you know, the pub at the top. And he sat there. It just stalled. He put the brake on. And he sat there looking at front yard. He said, hey, now it stopped. What's wrong with it? I wonder what's wrong with it. And he said, well, don't look at me, because Frankie Howard didn't know how to. He said, don't look at me. So they sat there for quite some time. And of course, they were two old elderly men, and he had a car. I knew damn well what was wrong, but I didn't like to say. And he suddenly said, hey, Frank, he said, does thee know? He said, I've forgotten to change gear. Now, would you ever get that today? He'd driven all that way from Knutsford in top gear. And the cars of those days tended to be low geared. You could put them in top and forget about, because people were frightened of changing gear. It was one of the things that, you know, they just didn't know how to change gear somehow. And it wasn't easy because there was no synchromesh. Tended to make no awful noises. Eventually, he got it going, and we had no further trouble. We got there and back to Knutsford. But he was so deep in conversation, he didn't know it, you know.
It's another age, isn't it, really?
It was. So those are the, as I say, you can take those with you if you want to. Yeah. If there are any use, because if you're referring or seeing anybody else, I'd like to know if there's any people remember. Yeah. I'd like to talk to Sid about it, but I haven't seen him, of course, since I've spoken to you.
I'll follow those up for you.
Sid would remember his name if he was, and Mrs. Calderwood would know.
Yeah.
Because he was well known in Cheshire, as I say, as a delphinium grower, and he often toddled around the nursery, although he'd been retired for years. I was told by this other chap the driver, Arthur Cholton, who I remember well, there was two. There was John Chapman and Arthur Cholton, and they both. Arthur was the head man, like, and he drove the biggest lorry, a big common they had, but he also sort of did the servicing, seemed to service the vehicles. He looked after them. But I went with him once to Point and Show. They used to set a stand up Caldwell's at all the local shows. Altrincham Show was another. And I went with him to help to set the stand up before the show day, with all the plants and the stuff was on the wagon. And that man, he was getting on a bit then, but apparently I was told recently that he was still worked there in his 90s and still driving. Whether that was true or not, I don't know. But he could drive, there's no problem. But he was a twist smoker. In those days, a lot of men, working men, smoked twists because it was cheaper than buying tobacco with a name on it. Mm. They got a black wadge of it, greasy black wadge of it, and they'd cut it with a penknife and stuff it in the pipe. And old Caldwell didn't like smoking, the old man. And he'd shout at anybody smoking, he seemed to put it out. And Arthur didn't smoke his pipe in the presence of, if he saw the boss. He put the pipe, even lighted, in his pocket. But he'd chew it. He'd chew the twist with it. And all this staining was around his... Now, to talk about nicotine poisoning, that man was in his mind. Now, his daughter-in-law used to come in our shop, Pat Charlton, and he'd been to see his son in Wigan. The son lived in Wigan. And as I say, he must have been in his 90s by this time. He had a little 1100 car of his own then. And he's taken his wife up to see his son in Wigan. This is the story Pat told us. And still smoking his pipe. And they came back, the motorway was open then, of course. Came back before they got to the turn off for Knutsford. He pulled his 1100 onto the hard shoulder, switched off, handed his wife the key. She says, because she didn't drive. I said, what are you doing that for, Arthur? He said, I'm sorry, missus, you're going to have to hitch a lift home. That was it, gone. How he got the presence of mind to take that car off the road and switch the engine off, God in heaven's knows. But he must have known what was happening. He just had a heart attack. And yet he'd driven all those years. And it smoked and chewed that damn stuff all the time. And he'd spit it out now and again, you know. It was, a lot of the men did actually. Yeah. It was very common. But I started smoking because I used to smoke herbs. My father used to drive comfrey in the oven when it was hard to get tobacco in the war. And we used to smoke that. But when I learnt to bud, all the men smoke, you know, mostly fags or a pipe. And of course, in the field, you know, when you were budding, you were pestered with flies. And midges. It was just that time of the year because you were budding in midsummer. It was hot with midges. So, of course, you can imagine I was suffering. You were like this, and then, and you'd do that and take a piece out of your ear because it was like... So I said to my mother, you know, I'm going to have to start smoking. I'll keep these flies off. All the men... So she gave me some oil of citronella. And I used that for a bit. The vapour was supposed to. But of course everybody, oh God, that smell, that stuff. Why don't you get some tobacco? Can that, drive us mad. So they didn't like the smell of this stuff. So I got myself a little pipe. And of course, once you got that going, the smoke kept the midges away. And that's how I became addicted to smoking a pipe. But I never smoked twist. But I went to Point and Show with Arthur in this lorry, and I think I must have had some herbs or something, you know. Oh God, I've smelt enough of that. Have some decent. So he cut me a bit of twist and put it in my pipe, and I lit it. I'm not kidding you. I've never felt so ill in my life. After half an hour, everything was going round. I felt so sick.
Yes.
But he smoked it all his life. And he never had a day's illness. He never was off.
Goodness.
But I have a cousin at age 88 who lives in Denton, who was in the RAF during the war. And he chain smoked cigarettes. You can cut it. I don't like to visit it because his wife's dead now, but he lives on his own. He won't go around the corner for a newspaper without getting the car. He can drive, which is more than I can. There's nothing wrong with his eyesight. He never hardly has a cold. He's never ill. He doesn't have arthritis like I have. He's 88 and he smokes constantly, so there's no justice,
there's
is there?
There's no justice in the world at all. Anyway.
No, but that was Arthur, but... his relatives, I think, still live in Knutsford.
Well, I'll follow up what I can.
Yes.
But What I'd like to say is, Ken, thank you very much indeed. I mean, you've got a wealth of memories and things here, which I think we're really going to enjoy. So thank you.
Yes, well, you're welcome. I'm sorry I can't remember any more, but, well, I probably will when you've gone.